Park Place Discussion Meeting, Sunday afternoon, 22nd May 1977. In the second volume of the Long Discourses of the Buddha, in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, the discourse which is entitled The Great Mindfulness, the second and third truths of the Four Noble Truths are presented by the Buddha in detail. I have just summarized them here in this book. The coming to be of ill is due to craving, potent for rebirth, accompanied by lust and self-indulgence, seeking satisfaction, now here, now there, namely the craving for the life of sense, for becoming, that is ambition, this, that and the other, and also for super-becoming. Craving arises out of the senses, including imagination, the objects of sense, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, intentions, memories, preoccupation and deliberation arising out of the use of the senses and objects of sense. The cessation of ill is brought about by the utter cessation of and disenchantment about that very craving, giving it up, renouncing it, emancipation from it, detachment from it, by putting away material things, the use of the senses, that is actually the misuse of the senses, the objects of sense, and by putting away thoughts, stimuli, feelings, perceptions, intentions, memories, preoccupation and deliberation arising out of the senses and sense objects. It's a terrifying prospect, really. But it is most instructive to study this and to meditate on it as much as one possibly can. You see, all these elements which have been mentioned, thoughts, feelings, intentions, preoccupations, that is to say self-preoccupation within oneself, as a result of sense experience and so forth, as the result of craving generally. All this acts as matter which chokes up the mind as such. It prevents right perception. It prevents understanding. It keeps the mind continuously in an impure state, using the word impure in its meaning in the religious context, cluttered up. The consequence is that it renders us incapable of true meditation. True meditation begins when the psyche is free of all this clutter, or at least when, in the fully awake state, physically awake state, the sense functions have become pacified, calm. And then the heap of memories, intentions, preoccupations with or the worldly life, they become less obstructive. When they are completely out, then true meditation can begin. Not till then. Now, we have talked about considering together. And you may recall I mentioned that this requires that one pay full attention, complete attention to what another person is trying to put forward before us. Now, when we listen to the other person, because of all this clutter in the mind, and because of our conditioning, and partly also because of the inescapable difficulty that language consists of words with precise meanings, this impure mind, this imperfect instrument of listening, is unable to pay full attention to the other person. Therefore, one cannot take in the reality of the content which the other person is trying to put forth before us and absorb it in our psyche. That absorption in the psyche is a very important aspect of it. Then one can respond rightly to the other person. It is in this way that one can consider together. If people are capable of considering together in something like this way, all the enormous heap of unnecessary argumentation, of disagreements and also agreements, all that will disappear. What will be there then? True understanding. And out of true understanding, there can be only one thing which emerges out of it. Right action. And right and perfect relationship between two human beings who are in real inward communication with each other. Then that sort of considering together is truly fruitful. So I have tried to link up this third truth, particularly of the cessation of craving, to free oneself from craving, in quoting this and suggesting how we might understand it. To link up true meditation with that, and also the possibility of considering together. The peace of the world can very largely be determined by this art of considering together in the right way. But you see what it implies, what it necessitates. Being well aware of all this clutter in the mind, putting it away, as the Buddha says. You can't put it away like we take an object and put it away. Putting it away means to be so fully aware of it that it ceases to obstruct. It's perhaps comparable to a road which carries very heavy traffic. If you're really attentive, you do not have a collision or some sort of accident. If you're inattentive, in a split second, there can be disaster. Somewhat like that. Now, for our discussion, shall we take the subject of doubt, which I suggested this morning? Doubt. And before we start, we'll have a few minutes of silence in which you can let your mind rest quietly on the meaning of that word doubt, its significance, its implications, how it affects oneself, and so forth. And after your mind is prepared, we'll start the discussion. Right?
I'd like to suggest we consider the difference between doubt and scepticism, because we are enjoined to be sceptical, but not disbelieving, of the ancient teachings, so that we may take out what is relevant to us at the time. Is this not so?
I would like to suggest that it seems to me that without craving and with perfect mindfulness, there can be no doubt.
I would like to say that I think doubt is a great safeguard, and scepticism prevents people from getting carried away all in one direction, and keeps a certain balance of mind, which is wiser than being too fanatical after one type of thing. And a shrewd, wise person has a certain amount of doubt about everything until they've considered it thoroughly and weighed it up.
That's a very interesting point you've brought out, because there is that aspect of doubt which invariably goes with continued inquiry. Is this really so? Or is it only partially so? Can it be put in a better form, etc.? You see? Now that doubt, as we can all agree, is a healthy doubt, a healthy sort of agnosticism. I do not know fully. I do not really know the whole truth. Therefore, keep the mind open and not be too certain, because that becomes a fixation that this is the truth or that this is not the truth. That's a very good point.
With this doubt, it becomes more difficult to become opinionated or form firm fixed ideas about any certain thing. It is, as she says, it keeps a more open mind towards all such.
Of course, I think there's also a danger in the fact that you can get to a point where you doubt your own judgment and you get completely bedazzled and you don't know which way to go. You can get in a fearful muddle through doubt as well on the other side.
So that was the sort of doubt that I thought was, well, I may be mistaken, but I thought that was the sort of doubt that was being considered.
No, you didn't make any mistakes. That was a very good point you brought out. Where there is the cessation of craving, and mindfulness, then there can be no doubt, you see. But the statement, there can be no doubt, is not made absolutely. All such statements are only relative statements. One is reminded of Aristotle's famous saying, there is nothing in the universe of which anything can be absolutely said. And even this cannot be absolutely said.
I'd like to touch on this on the practical side, that on the practical side, that where doubt is expressed as to the success of any project, we should really be grateful for it, because this way we can meet the difficulties ahead. We can prepare to meet the difficulties ahead, don't rush into things. And the other thing is, from that also, we must be sensitive to a slight feeling of doubt within ourselves.
It avoids ourselves becoming cocksure. Yes, Beth?
The master tab, where the Buddha said, try everything. Find from your own experience if it's good or if it's not good. And then it seems that often doubt has some fear in it, that it's afraid to try. As the Buddha suggested in the Kamala Sutta, when we know from our own experience that this is good or it is not good, doubt can be a form of fear of making any decision. That's one that must be right.
Because doubt can be a mental block. It can be a negative state and a mental block which stops you from seeing through. Sometimes one has to put doubt aside and try.
Yes, that is an important point.
It would seem that where doubt occurs, to help one to look, then it's a good thing, but when it occurs to stimulate discrimination, then it is not a good thing.
Yesterday you said someone was a bit gullible, which implied, I think, absolutely lack of any good doubt. Again, gullibleness.
Yes. Gullibility as well, and credulity on the one hand, and incredulity on the other hand, they are both extremes for which the cure is to be open-minded enough to doubt one's own credulity or incredulity. Then it helps one to steer a middle course, shall we put it in that form. I remember very well Krishnamurti in the 1920s, in one of the campfire talks at Omen, saying, doubt everything. Doubt is a healing ointment. Without doubt, you cannot become one with the truth.
He says, I
if one knows how to utilize doubt until there is full enlightenment, then doubt has served its purpose.
I think, Philosopher, you have said that doubt is embedded at every rung of the ladder, and is that not in an extreme form, the dark night of the soul? What they call the dark night of the soul in its extreme form, is it or isn't it?
It certainly accompanies the dark night of the soul state, and it is so powerful, and in association with disillusionment brought about by previous perception, it is so powerful that it brings a terrible state of desolation. But one can go through it, and then finally doubts vanish, and one truly sees. Remember that truly seeing means a continuous seeing. In the ordinary way, we see only temporarily, in terms of time. We consider something, and as if we were solving some mathematical problem or something, we see this, that or the other. And then we say to ourselves, yes, I have seen it, I have understood it. And the tendency is to stop there. But that is not the end point where truth in reality is concerned. There is no end to seeing it. And it is a continuous process all the time. So there is an element of doubt present, which is very helpful, because you keep your mind open. You have questioned yourself. You say, yes, I have seen thus far, but is this the whole thing? Is this the whole reality? And so on.
Sensitivity. Is it a deep sensitivity?
It has to be associated with a deep sensitivity. A doubt is an intellectual negation, isn't it? An intellectual negation which need not totally negate, but at least it partially negates. Often it considerably negates, you see. And that enables one's sensitivity to perceive the truth to become more active and see more light. See, doubt really is an essential ingredient of true faith. True faith is not blind belief. true faith is not a fixation. It is not a stopping at an end point. It is something which grows, and one of the elements which helps it to grow is the right sort of doubt, the healthy doubt, the doubt which makes you inquire more and more. In this connection, it is interesting to consider how in all the great religions we are told you must have faith in the founder, the Buddha or Christ or Muhammad or Zarathustra or whoever it is. We must have faith in them. Now consider, for example, the word Buddha, the enlightened one. In the ordinary way, when it is stated, have faith in the Buddha, one immediately thinks of the person Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha. And the mind is more or less shut to the fact that Siddhartha Gautama was the embodiment of the enlightened state. Now, what is it that we really have faith in? Faith in the enlightened state, in enlightenment, essentially. Because that is the universal and timeless reality. Whereas Siddhartha Gautama is an individual who was born, taught, and died. And after the death of the individual, what meaning can there be to having faith in that individual? But one can have faith, continued faith, and growing faith in that which that particular individual stood for and in his own person actually represented. Faith in the Buddha, for me at any rate, means faith in the reality of enlightenment, of wisdom, if you like. Sambodhi, the supreme wisdom. And the supreme wisdom is not a finite entity or thing. You see, this has no relationship to blind belief or to any sort of belief. Why not? Because a belief is a mental construct. It is a particular, finite, limited, mental thing, so to say. And that is perishable, impermanent, or to use the more abstract philosophical term, it is just relative. It is not the self-existing, self-subsistent, self-replenishing fact. That is why belief in actual fact has no place where faith is concerned. Faith goes with vision. When there is the vision there, an enlightening vision, not just an imaginative process, therefore, then there is real faith. And psychically, psychologically, it expresses itself in that feeling of coarseness. Of course this is so. You know the way in which if you present a rose or any flower or any object to a child, supposing it is a rose, and you ask the child, "What is this?" And it says, "That's a rose." And if you just proceed further and say, "What is a rose?" it will give you a look which will tell you just where you get off. and say quite smartly, "A rose is a rose, of course." It's that sense of coarseness. This is complete faith that the child has in the reality of the rose. But it's a faith which is comparable to the unconscious communion which nature displays. There comes the profounder stage when from within there is the enlightened state, and one sees not only that particular rose as the rose, but sees the roseness in it. Not rosiness, but the roseness in it, the ness, the essentiality of it. And seeing that is an extraordinary experience, because then you are not seeing merely with the physical organs of sight and interpreting it with the brain and the knowledge which we have obtained about a rose throughout our life, but we are seeing it transcendentally. The total mind is seeing it. And you see its roseness. And in that seeing, one experiences faith of an utterly different order. It is as if it's a new octave of perception altogether, quite transcending the ordinary octave of sense, activity and perception. This perception and this feeling is of the transcendental order which I feel the Buddha was talking of when he talks of the samapattis in the process of meditation and the final state of the cessation of perception and feeling. Our ordinary perception and feeling stops long before that, way back in the second jhana.
I don't really see where doubt comes in there, because doubt is an intellectual process. That's really not an intellectual step.
No, that is not an intellectual process at the transcendental level, and what we mean by doubt has no room there, obviously. Because then awareness is functioning in an entirely pure realm. It's a different dimension altogether of being and awareness. Non-discriminative consciousness. See, this ties up with the reality of meditation very much, as you will see.
Two forms of doubt, one a healthy one, one an unhealthy one.
Mm.
In fact, they're so far apart from each other that, you know, one wonders how they get the same name. You know, I recognise the healthy doubt questioning, which takes one on, and also the desperate doubt, one that leads you to utter and total despair because you can believe nothing, and nothing makes sense, everything is doubted. And yet they have the same name, and because they have the same name, maybe there is a connection somewhere.
In talking of unhealthy doubt, I had in mind more the idea of cussed cantankerousness. That sort of person. He's a nuisance. And in order to love him and be in right relationship with him, the golden silence is the perfect cure. You see, of course, as you said, there is that sort of person who somehow or other is perpetually doubting, entirely doubting. Well, it seems more like a disease of the mind to be that sort of doubter. Don't you think so?
I'm just thinking that in one and the same person at different states of mind, at different times, one can be in both, either state. One can healthily be in a state of questioning, but many times at different stages of one's life, one looks at things, and things which one believed and has experienced even, one knows one's experienced this previously, but in a certain state at a certain time, it's all gone. It's as if you never experienced, if you never knew. I mean, there will be times when we're sitting here this week and we've talked about the transcendent, and there's nobody, I doubt, here who will seriously doubt the whole, the very idea of the transcendent. You know, generally, there is a consensus. And we are in that. But there will be times, and there have been times, and there will be times, when one will sit down and consider this and really say, well, what a load of nonsense. You know,
yes,
I don't believe it, I don't understand it, I doubt it. The very essence of it. Although now, this week, no one would seriously doubt it.
The impressionability of the mind has an extraordinary range, you see, really extraordinary range. And there are maybe many reasons why it happens. The state in which the body is, the organism is just that way at that time, in that circumstance. And this doubt intensifies to such a degree that everything sort of fades away. And there's only this doubt, this destructive doubt, totally destructive doubt. But that too is really valuable for one's inward flowering. It's very valuable. One goes through this experience of inner destruction. But bear in mind that however terrible it may seem, there is no annihilation. It's like a direct hit from a big bomb. And there is a rubble heap. And yet, that very rubble heap can be utilized. Or, out of that very rubble heap, which one thinks is of such a nature that it is impossible for any living plant to emerge out of it. A living plant does emerge in course of time. How? You see, this terrible disintegrative activity, which is this complete, what seems complete destruction, is not altogether ill or evil. If one has inner poise to a sufficient degree and the caring for truth, let the truth emerge, the plant of truth will come out of that rubble heap. So even that kind of doubt has its place. I've experienced that myself. At least three times in my life. Once in my very young years, then I think somewhere during round about the 1930s, and again during the war years. And that was the worst of the lot. But of course, the prerequisite needed in order to be able to survive it, and to survive it not irretrievably maimed in spirit or mind, is the passion for truth, caring for it. What is it? Let it come whatsoever happens. Then, however awful the experience, you will come out of it. When one goes through that kind of destructive doubt, you may notice that your whole edifice of morality, of ethical values, absolutely goes with it. This is where you are tested to the uttermost. But you can come out of it. If, to use a theistic phrase, the love of God is there, if the love of the truth is there, not for the sake of this, that or the other, is this, that or the other to be loved, but for the sake of the love of the earth.
Doubt every part of our beliefs, inverted commas, saying it, before we actually understand the real being of that belief. Because surely most of, or not most, but certainly the things that we believe now, or we trust us to believe, we haven't got any real meaning of it until we realize it. Meanwhile, we have to have faith in it.
True faith, as it emerges and grows, you see, dissolves away beliefs. beliefs may be a starting point. They may be nutritive material, temporarily. But faith is timeless. A belief is subject to the ravages of time as well as circumstance. That's the difference. That's one difference between them. So as true faith emerges, belief disappears. Just as when there is true enlightenment, concepts vanish. See?
Is it the case that one does not believe anymore, one knows?
Yes. Yes, one knows in the true sense of the word know.
Well, then we can come back to doubt again, can't we? How certain are we the faith that we know of God is actually true? I mean, anything we can think of in finitude is relative truth.
Yes, true.
How are we certain?
That's quite true.
Faith we get.
So,
however, I mean, a lot of those dear people in the chapel think that what they've got is absolute faith. You couldn't shake them from it, quite rightly. But is it correct? It's only a facet of truth on this level.
Isn't that where doubt would then come in?
Doubt comes in.
Of course it will.
Our faith quite often turns out to be a belief.
Yes. 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 And this is where doubt helps us to discover that it was only something which the brain manufactured.
Taking the negative aspect of doubt, the mental block error, which was said some time ago, I think doubt is a very subtle thing and very deep-seated in the whole makeup of the person, and probably one of the hindrances most difficult to outgrow, one of the cankers of the mind to outgrow, the most, to me anyhow, the most difficult of all.
When we say the so-called faith that you spoke of just now must be what is true for you, and you accept that. You can't go any further than that, really, can you?
That is also true.
The anxiety is the true faith. From those who have the clear sight, the clear unknown insight that you mentioned, then it's not a matter of having to have faith, it's just seeing.
Exactly.
We also have to guard against thinking that we see, don't we? Because we can pull ourselves that way.
Yes.
In imagining that we can see things very clearly.
That's where doubt comes in.
Yes. But if we fool ourselves that much, thinking it is something really true, then we don't apply doubt to that. Because, you know, we say we know from some kind of inner experience.
Until we begin to suspect there's something
in there. But if we really think we know, then we will act as if it were true, and we'll soon find out then whether it's true or not.
Not everybody does, no, though.
But if you really, really think a thing is true, you do act on it, don't you? And then it lets you down if it isn't true.
I suppose one only can see at the time this is true. I mean, this changes one's understanding of truth from moment to moment, from day to day.
Yes.
a particular moment, I think, I think this is the truth, but then
but you ask that that's nothing static.
It's true or not, you live it, don't you? You have to live by what you really think is true, surely. It's if you hold back and just sit and say, I'm going to hold this as a belief, that proves that deep down you don't believe it. Surely you live by it. And then you soon find out. Like Buddha said, don't just believe it, what I tell you, but try it and see if it is so. In other words, live by this, and you will discover that there are different spheres between believing and doubting or thinking you know, and living something, and then it becomes manifest. Whether it's true or not.
Could we say that all fate we've ever arrived at is ambivalent? Forever deeply convicted, convinced we are.
To know that we do not know.
Quite an interesting point.
Well, look,
I don't know the answer to that.
In that room, as we just said, there are people with faith. There's no question about that. In another part of the world, there are people of Muslim faith doing similar things. Clean and utter, 100% faith of the Buddhists and Zarathustrians and many other people with clean and utter faith, all believing that this is it. And it can't all be it, can it?
But they are believers, aren't they?
Just a moment.
They're not.
Be careful, considering together, not argumentative. Be very careful. This is important. You see, when we get into that argumentative state, we immediately interpose ideas and throw them out. Take time, quietly absorb it, digest what the other person has said. You see? Otherwise, you know, the usual thing happens. We erupt into argumentativeness and we are just throwing mental brickbats at each other. Now, Sydney, you said they have complete faith, the Muslims have complete faith. Yes, you are using the word faith in that particular sense. I have tried.
You said earlier, didn't you, that after having belief, then you come to faith, and that's it, as it were. But in reply to that, I said, well, that is as far as the person concerned, individually, those people in there have faith. But so have other people, but they can't all be right. So faith is only a relative truth. Right?
It's all faith in the transcendent, really, and a different form, isn't it?
That's it, but they don't know it's a transcendent.
No, but that doesn't matter.
I think we have no right to say that different pathways to truth are untrue, because the form varies.
I feel when I was talking about large numbers of people, one can be pretty sure that they believe rather than have faith in the real stuff.
That is what I was turning over in my mind quietly. We say that these people have faith, or those people have faith. Now, for us, we have to try and perceive Is this real faith or is it rigidly fixed belief? Is it a fixation? There's a great gulf between the two. Faith is infinitely resilient. And that resilience is present because what the person says is the truth is not a fixed belief. See, it's a very difficult point, isn't it? Very difficult indeed. But here we have to learn to discern as best as we can just what it is.
Can't we only do this through our own experience? I don't feel that we can talk for other people.
No, true.
And in a way we are putting ourselves, if we do, as saying that we know,
yes,
that their belief is belief and not faith, and putting ourselves in once again in the position of saying that we have a better understanding than they.
A belief is what you call someone else's faith.
Beliefs, of course, are necessarily a starting point. We can't get away from that. The root of the word.
Of belief. Yes. Is it something that lives in one's being? Do you know what the root is?
No, not really.
Doesn't it have the German Liebe in it? Liebe.
I have. No, I think it's to do with lending or leasing one's being. By one's leasing.
I think the Oxford Dictionary. I think in the Oxford Dictionary, the etymology is love, leave. I think so.
I thought it would be something to do with a wish.
Yes,
a leaf would do something.
Yeah.
What do you say, Ingrid, to that?
It's like with the B, leave it. Leaf, maybe old German, I don't really quite know that. A leaf.
I thought it might be connected. This is all really is connected with the same. With I would leave do something. I would rather. I would wish, want,
yes,
desire to do,
yes,
something.
Yes. I don't know about this, but one of you might be able to elucidate. is the leaf part, L-I-E-F, related to the idea of loyalty? No.
I think it's to do with lend or lease one's belief, one's being, which you sort of put yourself out on something.
I think, doesn't it come from the believe to retain?
Yeah. We'll have to look it up in the 18-volume Oxford Dictionary.
My mind is going back to John Moore's, the title of John Moore's book, Make the Leap.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Make.
The fears, isn't that also a starting point in our lives? I mean, doubt in our circumstances, or doubt in our actions, or doubt in our selves. I think it's one of the biggest starting points on starting to consider the religious life, or something to take us out of our materialistic views and everything, doubting the life we have lived and everything.
Would you say, especially doubting the worthwhileness of our worldly activities?
Yes,
and
quite, yes, and if there's any sense in it all. And I think if we look at doubt in this way, I think we can say that it's our best friend.
Yes, truly enough, it is often our best friend.